I set myself a challenge last week, which I started, which was the challenge of why would anybody before Jesus believe in a physical resurrection? Like, why would anyone believe that before Jesus? Because you can observe what happens to a body when it dies, and it is not physical resurrection. Like, throughout all of history, people have been able to see that. They've been able to watch the body decompose. And so, given that that's what you see, why would anyone in the world come to believe in a physical resurrection before Jesus? That was a question I set us last week. And last week, I was saying that for the ancient Jew, it grew out of a couple of convictions. So number one was the conviction that the physical creation was good. You read Genesis 1, and you read again and again God declaring the creation to be good. So because they believed the physical creation to be good, they believed that whatever God had in store for his creation must be good, and it must be physical. And so that was the beginning of it. So they believed that God made a good creation, and because that, surely, at some point in the future, he would make a good new creation. And so that was where the beginnings of a belief in resurrection emerged in ancient Judaism. And then the second thing, which you get to in Genesis 3, is that death is an evil intrusion in God's world. It would be easy to look at the world and think, well, death is the most natural thing. It happens to everyone. You know, it's just this, you know, as I said last week, it's the Lion King circle of life. We live, we die, and that's just how it goes. It'd be easy to look at it and say, it's a completely natural thing. But that's not how we feel about it. We feel like it's an intrusion, and the Bible says we feel like that because it is. It wasn't God's intention for his good world. And so because they believed that the physical world was good and that death was an evil intrusion in it, they began to believe that this God who made a good creation would not let death have the final word in his world. He would raise the dead and speak a good new creation into being. This is what they started to believe. Now, this is important because without that, you don't believe in a physical resurrection. If you don't believe those things, you don't believe in a physical resurrection. You might believe in some sort of disembodied, ongoing existence after death, but you only think people will be physically raised if you believe that there is something uniquely good and important about the physical world. You have to believe that to believe in a physical resurrection. But the belief in the resurrection took hold not simply because of that, but also based on what they believed about the character of God. What was God like, and what did that mean he was going to do? One of my favorite activities over the past 5 or so years has been rereading all of the Harry Potter books with my children. It's been what has brought me great joy. I've enjoyed reading those over and again. I first read those books, when did I first read them? Like 20 years ago, more than 25 years ago almost, when I was in Brazil. I was in Brazil for 6 months, and my sister paid an exorbitant amount of postage fee to send me over the first 4 Harry Potter books. So she sent them over. There were only 4 at that point, so she just sent me all that there were, and she said, give these a read. Now, I was very, very skeptical about this, and I really wanted to dislike them. You know, the hype was huge. The first film had just come out. I was like, I am not going to enjoy these. But anyway, I picked the first one up, and I read it, and I was pretty much instantly hooked. I read them all. I'm of that generation where these were an important part of my life. But in recent years, I have begun to observe or become aware of a strange discussion going on in the world of Harry Potter. In fact, I'd go further than describing it as a discussion. I think it's become something of a movement. If you're someone who ever engages with the world of Harry Potter, you will have come across it, I think. It is this movement. It is the Umbridge is worse than Voldemort movement. Okay? You will, if you've ever kind of existed or come across it, you will have come across this. Umbridge is worse than Voldemort movement. It's become this thing that people constantly trot out. Now, I want to argue from the offset, this is objectively untrue. Okay? okay? It is just not true. Like, Voldemort is clearly worse. Like, he does all the worst stuff in it. And more than that, he is the leader. Without Voldemort, there is no Umbridge. Now, I'm aware I'm entering into a movement here that probably I don't want to, and I'm unqualified to engage with. But I just think it's clearly untrue. But it got me thinking, why has that idea gained such momentum? Why has it become so popular? Why has it become something that people talk about? And I think the main reason for this is Book 5, The Order of the Phoenix. You have this moment where Harry is there speaking the truth, saying, Voldemort's back, we need to take steps. And Umbridge is there treating him incredibly badly about this. So the more he tries to warn people, the more people refuse to believe him. He gets accused of lying or people are actively just hushing it up. The more Harry tells the truth, the more trouble he gets in. And what happens as you read this is because you empathize with Harry, you start the injustice of it all kind of creates an emotional response. You kind of have this emotional response to it. You read it and you think all the injustice. You think of how unfair it is. There's this kind of famous bit in it where she forces him to write over and over again, I must not tell lies, like old-fashioned lines. If any of you are at schools and had to write lines, it's the equivalent of that. But when he writes it, the pen sucks the blood out of his hand to use as the ink and scratches it into his hand. So as he writes it over and over again, he's kind of engraving it in his hand. It's kind of one of these moments in the film where you're just watching it, just like, this is so unfair. It's infuriating to read. And the reason it's infuriating to read is because we find injustice hard. We find it hard to watch. So for you, it might not be Harry Potter, it might be whatever your cultural reference point is, but we find it hard to watch or to read or to see other people being treated unfairly. But more than that, we find it hard to experience ourselves. We hate it when we feel like we are being treated unfairly. I can think of times in my life where I've been blamed for things that I haven't done. And I can remember how angry that made me feel. I can also picture the face of my children when I accuse them of things they haven't done. You know, their outrage, their moral outrage, I could have suggested that they did this thing and that they might take the blame for something that they didn't do. We hate injustice. And often, if I'm honest, I imagine that I would deal with injustice better than I would. So I imagine, oh yeah, I'd be fine with dealing with injustice until a minor piece of injustice happens, at which point I get furious and angry and can't sleep at night and go over and over in my head how unfair it is. The reality is, we hate injustice. We long for justice to be done. We long to be vindicated, for everyone to know that we were right and didn't deserve what happened to us. And of course, that's what happens in Harry Potter, because that's what happens in stories. You know, by the end of the book, Harry's vindicated. Everyone sees Voldemort returns and knows that he was right all along. By the end of the seventh book, by the end of the series, Umbridge gets her comeuppance. You know, they have the fight, she gets defeated, and justice is done, because this is what happens in stories. The problem is, this isn't always what happens in the real world. Sometimes people are unjustly treated and no justice is ever found for them. Sometimes the level of injustice results in the death of innocent people, and once someone's dead, there's no rolling back from that. There's no, oh, well, it's all right, we'll make it all okay again. Sometimes people perpetrating injustice in the world, they get away with it. They just get away with it. Maybe they only get found out after they've died. We've seen a lot of that recently. People who've done horrendous things only to be discovered after they've died. Maybe no one ever finds out. Maybe there's a whole host of injustices in the world that we just know nothing about. Almost definitely there will be. Maybe people know about it, but they lack the power to be able to do anything about it. They know it's unfair, but the people committing the injustice are just too powerful, and there's no way to deal with it. Now, this was a problem in ancient Israel as much as it's a problem for us today. We're going to join this story of ancient Judaism at around 700 BC. And if you know anything about the history of Israel, it's pretty sketchy. They have already suffered enslavement by the Egyptians. They were rescued from there. They established their own land. But their own land wasn't a terrifically just place. There's story after story of the vulnerable being exploited and taken advantage of. Even in that land, more recently where Isaiah's writing, they've suffered at the hands of their own bad kings. Bad kings who've used their position for their gain rather than for the good of the people. And then on top of that, they've suffered at the hands of the superpower of the time, which was the Assyrian Empire. Just a couple of decades before this, the Assyrian Empire have invaded Israel. The northern kingdom, the 10 tribes at the top, they have been completely wiped out. They'll never be found again. That's the end of those 10 tribes. They're lost to history at that point. The southern nation, Judah, they end up paying tribute to keep them away, but it's brutal. It's an invasion in which we read women and babies were not spared. And Isaiah here, where we're going to look this week, Isaiah 26, he's writing after that, during a time of kind of relative quiet. The Assyrian power has begun to wane, a new superpower has begun to emerge, the Babylonians. And the question of justice, where will we find justice, is one of the primary focuses of the book of Isaiah. So, hopefully, you've got your Bible open at Isaiah 26, page 710. I'm just going to read the whole chapter to us now. So, Isaiah 26, page 710. In that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. So, Judah's the name given to the southern bit of Israel that still survives. We have a strong city. God makes salvation its wall and ramparts. Open the gates that the righteous nation may enter, the nation that keeps faith. You will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast, because they trust in you. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord himself is the rock eternal. He humbles those who dwell on high. He lays the lofty city low. He levels it to the ground and casts it down to the dust. Feet trample it down, the feet of the oppressed, the footsteps of the poor. The path of the righteous is level. You, the upright one, make the way of the righteous smooth. Yes, Lord, walking in the way of your laws, we wait for you. Your name and renown are the desire of our hearts. My soul yearns for you in the night. In the morning, my spirit longs for you. When your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness. But when grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. Even in the land of uprightness, they go on doing evil and do not regard the majesty of the Lord. Lord, your hand is lifted high, but they do not see it. Let them see your zeal for your people and be put to shame. Let the fire reserved for your enemies consume them. Lord, you establish peace for us. All that we have accomplished, you've done for us. Lord, our God, other lords beside you have ruled over us, but your name alone do we honor. They are now dead. They live no more. Their spirits do not rise. You punished them and brought them to ruin. You wiped out all memory of them. You have enlarged the nation, Lord. You have enlarged the nation. You have gained glory for yourself. You have extended all the borders of the land. Lord, they came to you in their distress. When you disciplined them, they could barely whisper a prayer. As a pregnant woman about to give birth writhes and cries out in pain, so were we in your presence, Lord. We were with child. We writhed in labor, but we gave birth to winds. We have not brought salvation to the earth, and the people of the world have not come to life. But your dead will rise, Lord. Their bodies will rise. Let those who dwell in the dust wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. Go, my people, enter your rooms and shut the doors behind you. Hide yourself for a little while until his wrath has passed by. See, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the earth for their sins. The earth will disclose the bloodshed on it. The earth will conceal its slain no longer. Okay, so by the end of this chapter, what you have is one of the clearest demonstrations of a belief in physical resurrection that you have in the entire Old Testament. You have this account of the dead being raised. But in order to understand that bit, which is where we're going to spend most of our time, we do need to just understand the flow of the passage. So just let me, just a couple of minutes just to unpack this. So the first six verses of this chapter are basically articulating a great reversal that they believe is going to take place. A reversal whereby the righteous are secure in peaceful cities, and those who oppress, attack, and trample down these cities are themselves cast down. You can see this this great reversal articulated in verses 5 and 6. God is going to humble the lofty. And how will he do this? Well, the feet of the oppressed and the footsteps of the poor will trample them down. Do you see the reversal? Instead of the oppressed and the poor being trampled by the powerful, it's going to be the other way around. The poor and oppressed, they are going to bring judgment on the oppressors. And so this is where it begins. It begins with this looking forward to a great reversal that they believe God will bring about in this world. And as they look forward to that, verse 7 to 18 articulate what life looks like right now. So if verses 1 to 6 is looking forward to this great reversal, the question is, how do they live now while they wait for that? And the answer is, they live in this period of a long wait. Verse 7 to 18 talk about this long wait. They are waiting for God to act in this way. They yearn for God's judgment to come on the earth. They are, to take the picture at the end, they are like pregnant women about to give birth, suffering pain, but looking forward to salvation being born, although, interestingly, a salvation that they have been unable to bring about or give birth to themselves. This passage kind of deals with one of the common themes of the Old Testament, which is when faced with the suffering of the righteous and the prosperity of the wicked, they look forward to a future day when this would be reversed. So they look around the world and they go, we look around the world and what do we see? We see that sometimes the righteous suffer unjustly and sometimes the wicked seem to prosper. It's not always the case, but sometimes this happens. And they go, well, this can't be how it's always going to be. So they begin to look forward to a future day when that will be reversed. The righteous will be vindicated and the wicked will finally face justice. Now, why did they believe that this day was ever going to come? Was it just wishful thinking? Were they just looking at the world and just going, hey, we just hope this is going to happen, so we're going to believe it? Well, they believed it was going to come because they believed in two truths that they had to reconcile. The first truth was that they believed that God was a just God. Because God had told them over and over again that he was. He'd told them many times, I'm a just God and I hate sin and I cannot tolerate it. He hates all wickedness. He cannot abide the evil done by people in his world. And God cannot be just and allow wickedness to go on unimpeded and unpunished. He cannot be just if he's simply going to allow the righteous to suffer unjustly over and over and over again. And so that was the first truth that they had. They believed that God was just. But the second truth that they had to face up to was that life clearly wasn't always just. Whilst justice is often done, and whilst we should, as individuals and as nations, pursue justice, it is undeniably true that sometimes the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer. And for them, for Old Testament Israel at this point, this was most clearly seen for them in the martyrs. Most of the bits that talk about the resurrection are talking about people who've been martyred, been killed for their faith. You see it here. It talks about their blood, kind of the earth will disclose the blood shed on it. You see, they were looking at the martyrs and they were going, okay, here are some people who faithfully loved and followed God and yet were killed by Israel's enemies, and they had clearly not received justice. The individuals and nations who did this prospered, and as they were dead, there was no opportunity for the martyrs to receive justice now. And so they had these two things that they had to reconcile. How can God be just when the world so clearly isn't just? How can both these things be true? And the solution to this problem was found in the resurrection. Whilst justice clearly wasn't done now, they began to believe that at the resurrection it would be. At the resurrection, the dead would be raised and justice would finally be done. The righteous would be vindicated and the wicked punished. And that's why, if you were to look through the way the Bible talks about the resurrection, that's why it's so often linked with the thing we don't like talking about, which is God's judgment. The resurrection is often in passages that also talk about the judgment of God. They come together because that was what they needed if God was going to be just in a world that clearly wasn't. And we see that happening here at the end of this song. So if 7 to 18 is the long wait, then verses 19 to 21 is the kind of what we're waiting for, the resurrection and the final judgment. And when will the waiting be done? When will this great reversal take place? Well, it will take place when our dead bodies are raised. To take the language of this song, when our dust is once again formed into new life. Then, we're told, the righteous will wake with shouts of joy and receive the justice that they were so clearly denied in their lives. And the wicked will rise to judgment where they will receive punishment for their sins. The blood that they have spilt will cry out against them and there will finally be justice. And so what we see in the Old Testament about resurrection is we see that a belief in resurrection came out of a belief in four central truths. The world was good, truth number one. Death is bad, truth number two. God is just, truth number three. The world is often not just. Those four truths were the truths that underpinned the ancient Jewish belief in resurrection. In a world where no one else believed in physical resurrection, no one else in the ancient world believed in it, the ancient Jews were set apart because they did, and this is why. And so next week, as I said, we're going to look at the event which changed this from a worldview based on certain beliefs about the world and about God to the centerpiece of Christianity. We're going to look at how that happened. Next week on Easter Sunday, we'll get into a gospel and we'll look at that first Easter where what they hoped for became a reality. But before we get there, I just wanted to highlight three things from what we've looked at this week that we've seen about the resurrection. Three things that we can kind of take away and think about and work through ourselves. Here's the first. First, I want you to recognize if there is no resurrection, then the world is not just. Okay, I want to start there. Without the resurrection, you have to accept that evil people who get away with it simply get away with it. And that good people who are mistreated are nothing more than good people who are mistreated. That's your worldview. If you don't believe in the resurrection, that's what you believe about the world. You have to. There isn't another option. When you see on the news accounts of people doing terrible things, you can, if you don't believe in the resurrection, you can hope that they get some justice now. But you know that for many, there will be no justice. For many, this world will simply be made up of the strong exploiting the weak and the powerful taking advantage of the vulnerable. And what we'll probably do is we'll get more and more sophisticated ways of doing just that. We may even create ways of doing it where we're so far removed from it that we don't even feel bad about it anymore. But a just world, that's not an option for us. If we don't believe in the resurrection, it's just not going to happen. There is no way it can happen. All you've got to do is look at the world to know that that's not going to be a reality for us. And more than that, if you are not going to believe in the resurrection, then you have to accept that if there is a God, he is not a just God. God is not a God who will hold people to account for their actions. God will sit back. He'll maybe advise. He might disapprove. Maybe at some point he'll act in this world, but if there's no resurrection, then he is clearly not going to bring about justice in this world. If you want to hold on to a belief that this world can be a just place or a place where justice is ever done, then you need the resurrection. Without the resurrection, that goes. That's the first thing I think we need to take away. The second is this. If there, and it's obviously very closely linked, if there is no resurrection, that means we can live however we want. Basically, the only consideration needed when deciding whether to do something we want or not is simply, can we get away with it? That's it. That's the only consideration you've got to make. Can I get away with it? And as we as a society move away from the kind of vision of the resurrection that the Bible has, a physical resurrection which will involve the judgment of God, increasingly people feel free to act with complete impunity. They do what they like as long as they think they can get away with it. As long as they think they can keep it hidden, then there will be no consequences. As long as they are powerful enough to avoid the consequences, then they can act as they want. But as Christians who do believe in the resurrection, we do not believe that we can act as we want. No, we believe that that at the resurrection, even the secret things will be laid bare. And that has a whole host of implications. I'm going to give you a few of them. It impacts our ability to forgive others and overlook sin. We can forgive and overlook the sins of others because we can trust that in the end, God will ensure that justice will be done, and we know that his justice will be a lot better than our guess at what would be just or not ever could be. If you believe that justice will be done and that God will do it perfectly, then you can let go of having to do that yourself. It's not to say, as I said before, that we don't pursue justice individually and as nations, but it just means it doesn't have to consume us. The second impact it has is it impacts how we view ourselves. Because it means that we believe that forgiveness is required for even the sins which no one else will ever know about. I don't only need forgiving for the things that I do that other people see and that I'm ashamed of. I need forgiving for all the things that no one ever saw, because God does see those things. And it also impacts how we interact with other people. So to take an example, we reject hypocrisy. We are free to be ourselves because we believe that what is hidden is as important as what's seen. Doesn't matter what front you put on. We don't need to pursue hypocrisy because what's hidden is as important as what's seen. And then finally, the final thing I think we take out of this as we look towards next week is by understanding the way that the Old Testament talks about the resurrection, we start to understand what Jesus was actually doing when he died and came back to life. Because Jesus' death and resurrection is the fulfillment of these Jewish beliefs, a belief in justice, a belief in the goodness of the physical world. So Jesus' death and resurrection is the moment when we see Jesus assert the goodness of the physical world. If the physical world wasn't good, then God wouldn't have entered into it physically. If the physical world wasn't important, then Jesus wouldn't have physically suffered and died and been physically raised. If Jesus' death and resurrection, in that we also see just how evil death is. In Jesus' death, we see the brutality of death. If death was not a great evil, then Jesus would not go through all of that to defeat it. If death was not an evil, then Jesus would not triumph over it by being physically raised. But in Jesus' death, we also see the justice of God. We see just how seriously God views all the sin and wickedness of this world as Jesus suffers all the consequences and all the judgment of that sin. In Jesus' death, we see justice being done. And then in Jesus' resurrection, we see the righteous being vindicated. we see that justice will be done as the innocent one is raised to a new, incorruptible, imperishable, perfect life. And that, therefore, is ultimately our hope. You see, our hope is not, oh, well, I'm basically a righteous person, so at the resurrection, I will be raised with the righteous. No, our hope is that Jesus is the righteous one who has already been raised and now offers us his righteousness. Our hope is that Jesus on the cross took all the justice for our unrighteousness, and that Jesus through his death offers us his righteousness so that now on that resurrection day we can be raised as the vindicated righteous who finally enjoy the goodness of creation which God created us to enjoy.